Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. I'm Captain Ed Garibay, and in today's podcast, we'll be talking explosive ordnance disposal, commonly referred to as EOD, and their role in large-scale combat operations. When you hear the term EOD, it's almost impossible not to think about counterinsurgency, terrorists, and improvised explosive devices, also known as IEDs. Some might even be tempted to think that the explosive ordnance disposal branch spawned from the global war on terror. But as it turns out, EOD has its roots all the way back to World War II, when they were referred to as the U.S. Army Bomb Disposal. And they continued their service through the Korean War, Vietnam War, and all the way up to today. Here to discuss EOD and its evolving role in today's military is Colonel Sean Cadleck, the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Commandant for the U.S. Army. Sir, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here. Always good being back at Fort Leavenworth. Thank you.
So, sir, we like to start each show with a strong doctrinal foundation and understanding of the subject. And especially for EOD, I know many of us have kind of a preconceived notion of what EOD is from our experiences in counterinsurgency, also known as COIN. So I'm going to start with a formal definition of EOD from JP3-42, Joint EOD Operations, and ATP4-32, EOD Operations, which define it as the detection, identification, on-site evaluation, render safe, exploitation, recover and final disposal of explosive ordnance and the organizations engaged in such activities. Now, that's what doctrine says it is, but in layman's terms, what is EOD?
Yeah, so, it's definitely a lot of things to a lot of people, and you know, based on some of those preconceived notions, people definitely have their opinions. But at its most basic, EOD really is the Army's only capability that's been trained to positively identify U.S. and foreign munitions, to include, you know, the weapon systems, improvised munitions, IEDs, and, to include Seaburn munitions and other weapons of mass destruction. There's lots of other MOSs that use explosives, you know, a lot of MOSs that absolutely can't identify the U.S. munitions that they're using. A couple of other MOSs are trained to do emergency destructive U.S. munitions, but we're the only ones that are trained across the depth and breadth of U.S. and foreign material.
And there's a role for EOD outside of just insurgency. It's kind of an ongoing activity, is it not?
Yeah. So, you know, the definition that's in doctrine, obviously very doctrinal and a little stiff. One of the things that I absolutely love about being an EOD officer in this career field is that EOD is something that is employed every single day in support of the nation. One day you're doing a target insertion in support of a range at Fort Liberty. The next day you're, you know, literally responding to a stockpile of Civil War cannonballs in Pittsburgh. After that, you're in Detroit, you know, supporting the president and keeping him and other dignitaries safe. And next month you're in Vietnam doing mine action, training the Vietnamese to do demining. So it's a very, you know, a capability that spans across a wide array of different missions and skill sets, all supporting the nation every single day.
So before we get into our large-scale combat or LISCO conversation, there's something that I see a lot, and that's EOD is commonly confused with the engineers. But it's actually a logistics branch in the Ordnance Corps. So what's the big difference between EOD and engineers?
Yeah, so great question there. The specifically as it relates to combat engineers and combat engineering, when you get into FM3 TAC 34, you're going to see things like shaping the physical environment, denying enemy mobility, accelerate concentration of combat power, limit enemy ability to generate forces and tempo. EOD doesn't do those things, you know. So to the extent that engineers are using mines, obstacles, breaching minefields, breaching obstacles to achieve those effects, that's not how EOD is employed or uses explosives. EOD doesn't do that. You know, we obviously don't employ mines. We're not planning for minefield emplacement. We don't do the breach of a minefield or obstacles. What we do do is mitigate the risk that explosive ordnance poses to our forces, critical infrastructure, and terrain. So whereas a, you know, the engineers are going to do the breach, once that breach is clear, that breach lane becomes a movement corridor of some sort. And that's where EOD is going to get applied. How do we make that breach lane safer for follow-on forces?
And I think a lot of it comes from the cross-warfighting function nature of EOD, because they kind of straddle the line between sustainment and protection, not to mention they have their hat in a number of other warfighting functions.
You know, at the ground level, you know, everybody loves to debate which COE we belong to.
Yeah.
And that debate between sustainment and protection misses the point. We just limit ourselves to sustainment protection. We're really missing that cross warfighting function capability that we provide.
And my understanding is that EOD has some links to the intelligence warfighting function as well. Could you help our listeners understand that connection?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, one of the things I love about EOD is we are definitely a cross warfighting function capability. We have tasks rooted in sustainment, protection, and as you noted, intelligence. The capabilities and our responsibilities in exploitation will definitely vary from one conflict to the next. You know, in the counter IED fight, there was a whole lot of stuff that we could do as far as actual exploitation goes for, you know, as far as taking x-rays, gathering fingerprints, things like that. As we transition into LISCO, the Army's ability, you know, to quote unquote exploit in the field becomes a little bit more limited when we're talking about things like guided missiles and, you know, other high-end munitions. But the EOD role in that, you know, largely remains the same. First and foremost, positively identifying what that explosive hazard is, what that piece of munition is. Is it safe to move? If it's not safe to move, you know, rendering it safe if it needs to be collected. So at that point, we're going to do a render safe procedure. We're going to make it safe to evacuate to a rear area, and then let it get further evacuated, probably back to national capabilities somewhere where the scientists and others are, you know, available for that in-depth exploitation. But you know, up front, our mission remains the same, and that's mitigating the risk of the explosive ordnance hazard.
Thank you, sir. So how are we moving from counterinsurgency COIN into LISCO? How does EOD fit into LISCO? Because I think a lot of people, when they think about it, it's hard to kind of wrap their mind around what exactly this capability brings.
Yeah, so you hit it in your opening comments. Yeah, we were founded, you know, during what was arguably our nation's most significant LISCO conflict, and during World War II, you had, you know, back then we were referred to as bomb disposal. You had bomb disposal personnel supporting everything from the homeland to maritime operations, literally jumping over the sides of ships with a little more than a dive mask, flippers, and a knife. You know, all the way forward to supporting, and I'll use the term loosely, but special operations forces, you know, to preserve some of those critical, you know, dams, bridges, things like that. So really we're returning to our roots. A recent vignette, that describes one of our roles in LISCO, is the Ossalman airfield tragedy that occurred during, Desert Storm. You know, kind of the long story short, there is, you know, 3 days into the ground war, coalition forces seized the airfield. There was obviously, you know, airstrikes, artillery strikes on the airfield, with littered with UXO to include submunitions. And trying to make this story short, personnel started clearing that airfield who were not trained to handle those munitions, started stacking submunitions, and ultimately resulted in 10 KIAs. 37 wounded in action, two EOD techs who later committed suicide. So pretty devastating impact on, you know, from a human life toll. And I certainly wasn't there. I doubt the airfield got opened up any sooner, you know, than it would have if they just let EOD do its job. So that's, it's a, you know, an unfortunate but probably pertinent example of how EOD enables maneuver operations in LISCO.
It's definitely a sombering example, and I think it harkens back to, as you said, the initial origins of U.S. Army bomb disposal. which again was World War II. And as you know, sir, in World War I, bombs weren't all that terribly complicated.
Yeah.
So it didn't take any specialized training to dispose of them. But come World War II, that's when you started to see military, and particularly civilians, picking up these different mines and munitions that they weren't qualified to handle, and ended in deadly consequences. And so flash forward to today with the world, with the war in Ukraine, and you see these massive amounts of munitions being fired. And whether it's intentional or unintentional, there are going to be a number of munitions still remaining on the battlefield. And commanders will need trained technicians to keep soldiers and civilians safe. So with that, how can commanders incorporate EOD when planning for these types of operations?
So with those officers and senior NCOs, you know, again, particularly on division and corps staffs, bring to the fight is the years of experience that they have as platoon leaders, team leaders, platoon sergeants, company leadership, and everything that they've learned about employing EOD teams in combat and elsewhere. What they also bring is an understanding of the effects that munitions have on potential targets. That EOD planner can go in and say, hey, you know, as part of that targeting process, here's your expected dud rate for that munition. Here's how long, here's the risk of that UXO. Here's how long we can take to, expect to take to clear that. Maybe it changes the commander's decision on what munition gets fired. It maybe not, but at a minimum, it allows that staff to better prepare for follow-on operations and mitigate the risk of the UXO contamination that's about to occur.
So you used a term right there, sir, UXO contamination. And I think that's an interesting point when thinking about the transition from COIN to LISCO, and that's fratricide, because in COIN, traditionally, we think of EOD as a capability used in response to enemy action. But while it's certainly true in LISCO, there's also this aspect of friendly munitions on the battlefield. Because after we clear out the enemy, we've got to move into the same space we were firing explosives into.
Yeah, so the hard part that we have, especially as it pertains to integrating with, starting at the maneuver company all the way up through division and corps, you can't simulate that at a CTC rotation. You can't simulate that in a warfighter.
Yeah.
If you do try to do it, the rotation comes to a grinding halt. The warfighter comes to a grinding halt. Nobody's getting any training value. And again, we're not unique in that regard.
Unfortunately, that's not good either, because then commanders don't have an appreciation for the length of time it takes to do something like that. Like in your case, if there is unexploded ordnance on the battlefield, you're not going to be able to just drive through that.
My my favorite comment is, I was once told, hey, we'll just bounce a grid square or two left or right. Well, that's fantastic when you can. I don't know if anybody's looked at a map of Korea lately, but you're not bouncing a whole lot of grid squares left or right before you run out of grid squares. Yeah. It's just a knowledge gap at that point, especially for some of our headquarters and their role in risk mitigation.
So what are some of the ways commanders need to be thinking about this? Because as you know, part of being a good commander is knowing the right question to ask. So what are the right questions to ask?
You know, everybody's favorite answer, it depends. So EOD has requirements, has responsibilities, starting in the homeland and the strategic support area. And really moving forward into the deep maneuver area in support of Ranger Regiment and potentially some other soft elements as well. So now how we're employed, what our priorities are, at Echelon on the battlefield is certainly going to vary. What the 28th EOD company does in support of Ranger Regiment is going to be very different than what a company is doing back here in the homeland supporting mobilization and movement to ports and things like that. So it is largely going to depend on where you're at on the battlefield and that particular commander's mission. So I'll kind of start in the rear areas and maybe slowly work my way forward. As it pertains to the rear areas, be it back here in the homeland, the joint support areas, moving forward into the core, the EOD function at that point is, really about preserving, protecting that critical infrastructure, those ground lines of communications, everything that is essential to generating combat power and sustaining it forward on the battlefield. You also, you know, rear area, arguably perhaps a little bit more secure. So exploitation, doing some battlefield assessments of the munitions that we encounter is potentially a little bit larger role in those rear areas than they might be forward. Moving forward into the division, you know, the brigade, the battalion areas, you know, this is where we may start to blur lines with the engineers a little bit more, where it is absolutely more focused on sustaining tempo and momentum of the combat operations. You know, so for those commanders up front, it's really identifying what's that piece of terrain, what's that piece of infrastructure that poses the greatest risk to your operation and the mission overall. So maybe you need an EOD tech. You know, once that airfield is secured, you need some EOD to help mitigate all of the UXO and whatever other explosive ordnance hazards that may be there. You know, if you're doing a gap crossing of some sort, is that the only bridge within 50 miles of your AO that can be used to cross this river? If so, how important is that bridge? Does it need to be preserved? And if it has to be, how do you get rid of that explosive? You know, that thing is rigged to explode. How do you get rid of that? Who's the best poised to do it? And so it's really just identifying risk.
What are your thoughts about unmanned aircraft systems? And there's a lot of talk with the war in Ukraine, the amount of UAS that's flying around and that have loitering bombs and things of that nature. How can EOD help with that particular problem?
Yeah, so the EOD mission space inside of the broader counter UAS fight, you know, really kicks in, obviously, once the thing hits the ground. We're not the ones shooting it out of the sky in any way, shape, or form. We're not jamming it per se, none of that stuff. But once it hits the ground, if it's got ordnance on it, it probably needs to be an EOD tech that is either disposing of that UAS or separating the ordnance from the UAS itself. And then kind of another facet that I think potentially gets overlooked quite a bit is just because the UAS is on the ground doesn't mean it's dead. So if that thing's got cameras, microphones, tracking devices on it, that thing is still potentially recording and transmitting data. So, you know, again, that's where EOD comes into play, making sure that particular UAS system is safe to transport back if it's deemed important enough for further exploitation.
How's the EOD community evolving for this change from COIN to LISCO and adapting and modernizing?
So I think I'd say, you know, loosely three broad buckets. First and foremost is updating our doctrine. So we do have a full revision of 4TAC-32. That is, if it's not done with final field staffing, it's very close. And that'll be on the street. And just as if, and maybe more importantly, it's getting EOD equities written into other people's doctrine. I was articulating what we do. Offense, yeah. Defense, stability, yeah. And it's not a cookie cutter statement across each one. So probably not the first person in the Army to ever observe that we're not necessarily the greatest at reading our own doctrine. And so, you know, to the extent that people don't read their own doctrine, they're probably not really reading a whole lot of other people's doctrine either. So how do we get EOD equities into intel publications, maneuver publications, et cetera. So that's been one of our main efforts is a holistic push on doctrine updates. The second piece of that is taking a hard look at how our units are designed. We have a force design update that takes effect fiscal year 25, where we take our current EOD companies, and we're basically going to create two formations. The EOD companies that we know and love right now will continue to remain focused on division support. And then we also will have, you know, smaller EOD companies, fewer teams, really focused on those rear areas. As we go forward, we will continue to assess how we design the capabilities in those units. We do have a couple of actual airborne EOD companies. You know, do they need the same vehicles, the same equipment to support the 82nd seizing an airfield as that operational support company needs supporting a port facility back in a rear area? Probably not. You know, so how do we continue to tailor those unit formations without losing or compromising too much capability? So that'd be area number two. And then the third general bucket is, you know, like everybody else, material modernization. So how do we modernize our robotics platforms in light of the emergence of UAS? How do we balance ground robotics with UAS, new handheld detectors? You know, everything's in play in that regard.
So the first bucket you mentioned, sir, was doctrine. What are we using as a foundation for updating doctrine? Are there any specific examples or experiences we're drawing from?
A couple of general areas that I definitely keep in the back of my mind as we look at all of this. So number one, going back to our roots in World War II, what were we doing in World War II? And again, I alluded to literally jumping over the sides of ships with a little more than flippers and a dive knife. It happened. You know, everybody thinks of underwater and the Navy's the only one with the capability. But as we, you know, the Army continues to assess its need for maritime capabilities. So what are we doing in the littorals? What are we doing how are we addressing that risk in maritime environments? I referenced the All Salmon vignette from Desert Storm, the Kamisaya ammunition storage facility was another great example. You know, long story short, it was a very rushed emergency destruct of national level stockpiles of munitions, ended up containing chemical weapons, and it is now basically attributed, one of the contributing factors to Gulf War syndrome. So definitely a risk mitigation element. What role does an EOD headquarters play in LISCO, even if it's not direct command and control of EOD forces per se? Ukraine, yeah, absolutely. Looking at Ukraine and what's going on there. The interesting thing there for me is they are simultaneously doing humanitarian mind action with large-scale combat operations. So you can go out and do a quick Google search of Ukrainian farmers literally demining their own fields as ballistic missiles are flying overhead type of stuff. So, you know, unfortunately, we have current conflicts that we're learning from as well, you know, along with past conflicts.
And you mentioned the humanitarian aspect of it as well. And one thing I don't think we've touched on fully yet is that beyond large-scale combat, there's a humanitarian and defense support of civil authorities requirement for EOD as well.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. So we are mandated by federal law to support civil authorities. So any DOD munitions that are found off post, a military EOD unit somewhere is supposed to respond to it. So, I alluded to Civil War ordnance earlier. Prior to me taking company command way back when, my unit actually recovered some Revolutionary War ordnance. So there is ordnance from all of our previous conflicts. Our safety standards at ammunition plants have greatly improved. But World War I, World War II, it was not uncommon for some of these facilities to detonate and scatter munitions everywhere. And as you know, people are building houses or shopping malls, they're digging this ordnance up. So we respond to that kind of stuff. Every grandpa in World War II brought back a hand grenade at a minimum. So we continue to get plenty of those calls. And then the simple fact is there's not enough public safety bomb squads to go around. There's only, you know, roughly 420 of them across the entire U.S. A lot of them are part-time capabilities. So if the local authorities don't have the capability to respond to a suspect package or can't get there in a timely manner, we'll respond off post and support them as well.
So the second point you talked about as far as modernization was the organization. And so as we talk about changing organizations, where can commanders expect to see EOD professionals on the battlefield? And how should they be task organized to use them correctly?
So back to everybody's favorite answer, it depends, right? So we are definitely a very, you know, small, limited capability. At Echelon, commanders are going to have to make decisions on prioritizing scarce resources. It's not unique to EOD by any stretch, but what I would recommend for those commanders, you know, again at Echelon, and their staffs is ensuring that they have an EOD officer or senior NCO as part of their planning process, and then that subject matter expert can absolutely advise on the most impactful, best locations, missions, operations in which to employ EOD forces.
So speaking of the EOD technician, what does it take to be an EOD professional? Because I take it, you know, it takes a certain type of individual to walk up to a bomb that's about to explode and say, I'm going to disarm this. It's not like the movies where it's red wire, green wire. There's a lot that goes into this.
Yeah, so secret of the trade, it's always the red wire. So I'll let you in on that one. So absolutely. I mean, it definitely takes a degree of confidence in your abilities, and confidence in yourself that arguably bordering on arrogance. But arrogance gets you killed too. So it's a fine line. I'm going to boast about EOD techs. They're smart individuals. So you definitely need to bring a degree of mental acumen, some self-confidence, but you also need a high degree of self-awareness. So again, arrogance kills, and you need to recognize, you know, that EOD, team leader, EOD soldier needs to recognize when they're potentially a little out of their element and in over their head, and not be afraid to radio back for help.
What are some of the things you learn as an EOD tech? Because I'm sure there's a wide range of topics that you have to be familiar with.
We have some smart individuals, and you have folks with degrees in chemistry, electronics, electrical engineering, both officer and enlisted. So individuals can absolutely deep dive into some of the nuances of the field itself. But a great thing about the career field is the diversity of training that we do get. So, you know, we have our AIT just like everybody else. We have our captain's career course, our senior leaders course, ALC, all that stuff. But what we also have access to is a lot of joint and interagency training opportunities. So there's nuclear weapons courses through DITRA out there at Kirtland Air Force Base. EOD technicians will go train with all the various national laboratories. So think Oak Ridge, Los Alamos, things like that. And then there's ATF, FBI courses that we go to quite frequently. And then really just at the end of the day, there is absolutely nothing stopping us from calling up that Air Force EOD flight down the road, saying, hey, can we go crawl around on some F-16s today? Calling the public safety bomb squad with the local sheriff's department. It's quite frequent for a lot of that, you know, different type of joint interagency training to take place too. So one of the fun parts of the job.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I've heard the term anything from pipe bombs to nuclear warheads and everything in between.
It is literally everything from the disgruntled teenager in his mom's basement building pipe bombs to nuclear warheads.
So what would you say is the biggest difference between the EOD technician of the past and the technician of the future? Or is there one?
I don't know that there is necessarily a ton of difference. And so where I go with that is, you know, starting back in World War II, it was absolutely that EOD technician's brain. And it's still that way today. You know, we have robots, we have our bomb suit, we have all sorts of gee whiz gear. But at the end of the day, it's that EOD soldier's brain that is choosing when and how to employ the bomb suit, a robot, a jammer, whatever it is. So it still comes down to the individual soldier.
Well, sir, thank you for spending the time today. Are there any parting thoughts or anything we missed?
So always be recruiting, right? So if anybody listening to this has soldiers, or if you're interested or have soldiers in joining EOD, goarmysoft.army.mil/EOD. I'll get you all the information and the points of contact that you need. But otherwise, hey, thank you for having me. This is a ton of fun. And like I said, always great being back at Fort Leavenworth. So thank you.
Perfect, sir. Thank you for coming out on the show. Thanks for the conversation, and thanks for being a part of Breaking Doctrine.
Just like writing new doctrine as a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Our production is coordinated by Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by Mr. Zarek Fry. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Amazon, Audible, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, the Combined Arms Support Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Captain Ed Garibay, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.